It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at the future of baseball as MLB owners gather to elect a new commissioner.
Ira Glass kicked up a little dust recently when he dissed Shakespeare on Twitter after seeing Shakespeare in the park, writing, "John Lithgow as Lear tonight. Amazing. Shakespeare, not good. No stakes, not relatable. I realize I'm thinking, Shakespeare sucks." Those are the words of Ira Glass on Twitter.
And we weren't surprised to hear that here on Central Time. We had Glass on the show last August when he had this to say.
"The plot of Hamlet, I don't think, could be on an episode of This American Life because there's no one to relate to. Because I feel like we're looking for stories that are more emotional."
So the question's out there via Ira Glass: does Shakespeare suck? By that, we mean, is his work unemotional, unrelatable, as Ira Glass says? Are there legions of you out there who agree but have been too ashamed to say so? And we want to hear from you on this one right away. Do you secretly hate Shakespeare? If so, why? Do you think it's okay to admit it out loud or on Twitter that you think Shakespeare sucks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or post now on the Central Time Facebook page.
Joining us now to consider the argument is Holger Seim. He's a professor of English and theater at the University of Toronto. He's a devoted blogger and often writes about the theater of Shakespeare and his contemporaries. Holger, welcome to Central Time.
Hello.
So a week or two ago, as we just said, a lot of people kind of went nuts when Ira Glass tweeted that he thinks Shakespeare sucks. He backed it up. It wasn't just a throw-off comment. It was also the case he was making that he found it unrelatable and unemotional. What was your first thought when you heard about that?
Well, I mean, it struck me that there are really three different arguments that Ira Glass's tweet, as short as it was, sort of threw up, right? That A, Shakespeare is unrelatable, B, unemotional, and three, that therefore Shakespeare sucks. I think, you know, the question whether Shakespeare sucks is kind of, that's up to each individual reader and audience member to decide. Professional reasons don't think so, but the question of whether an author or that author's work is bad because it's not relatable, whatever that means, or because it's not emotional, whatever that means, I think that's actually more problematic and something worth discussing.
Well, let's take the claim unrelatable. Now, you wrote a piece about this on your blog, and what you kind of say is, well, yeah, he is unrelatable, but that's sort of the point. Do you want to take it from there?
Sure. So I think Ira Glass's point and sort of the idea of people who say things like that, the idea is presumably that because Shakespeare is 400 years old, Shakespeare's works are now no longer, they don't speak to us anymore because we don't live like that, like people 400 years ago anymore. The point I made in my blog post was that, well, actually, I don't think Shakespeare or Shakespeare's characters would have been more relatable to his contemporaries than they are to us, since Shakespeare sort of, by and large, wrote about characters that weren't of the same social status as members of his audience, or not even of the same historical period. Shakespeare wrote a lot of plays set in ancient antiquity or in ancient Britain. King Lear, the play that set off Ira's Herglass's tweet, is set in ancient Britain. He's not writing about contemporaries. He's not writing about commoners. He's writing about kings and dukes and earls. So there's a kind of distance between the audience and the characters in the way the plays are built. So this notion that fictional characters should be exactly like us, which is, I think, sort of what informs the concept of relatability, which is a very recent concept, that's a notion that's quite alien to Shakespeare, but it's also a notion that's quite alien to a lot of classical literature before the 19th century.
And let's go to our phone lines now. We've got Eddie with us from Viroqua. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, good afternoon. Great topic. I think that Shakespeare is very approachable, especially to younger people. I teach it. at the high school level have in the past. And I found when you propose the question to them and actually give them the information and let them make the critical thinking questions themselves, for instance, telling them that the gentleman from Stratford, you know, his daughters were illiterate, that he didn't leave any books in his will, you know, you sort of propose a mystery to them and say, maybe this guy wasn't the guy who wrote it, and a larger question emerges, they suddenly become very, very interested in the works. Plus, it gives them a context biographically to look at the plays differently through a different lens.
Okay, so looking at the historical mysteries that are sort of a bigger context within a context there. What do you say to that, Holger?
Well, I mean, they're kind of factual issues with that. I mean, we don't actually have any evidence that Shakespeare's daughters were illiterate. There are signatures that survive. The fact that Shakespeare doesn't leave very many items in his will at all. There was an inventory that's lost, so he probably owned books. They're just not listed in the will. So there's something that the mystery of Shakespeare's biography, I don't think, is actually the most productive way into the plays. However, what the gentleman just said, they used the word approachable, and I think that's a much more useful term than the term relatable. And I would agree that Shakespeare, obviously, as with any older author and as with any oldest author's works, we need students, high school students, any reader needs information, needs footnotes, needs cultural background information to find a way into those texts. But they can, that way exists, and if you walk it, I think there are many rewards there. But they're not the rewards of relatability. I don't think the point of reading Shakespeare or any great classical author is to find yourself there. I think the point is to find a rich, strange world of characters that are quite unlike us in many ways there.
And on the other hand, though, we do hear, I mean, I've heard all the time, people making the claim that Shakespeare is universal, and that's one of the reasons that directors often say that you can place Shakespeare in any period of time, from modern day to the original, and that seems to be sort of a given when you consider Shakespeare. So doesn't that mean that Shakespeare is supposed to be full of people who stand in for every man, for everyone?
See, I think that's a misunderstanding. I do think there is something, and people have written about this, critics have written about this for a long time, there is something about Shakespeare's plays and their characters that is unusually open to interpretation, or less certain than many other authors' works. The sort of exactly what the point of view of a particular play by Shakespeare is actually very hard to pin down. So to that extent, they're plays that remain very open to interpretation and that remain very open to different generation after generation from different and different angles. And that is a quality that is somewhat rare, and it's something that Shakespeare apparently was very good at. But I don't think it's because the people in the plays are everyman characters. I think it is something about the density of the language. It's something about the slipperiness of the ideas and the ideological positions. It's something about the richness of the themes that Shakespeare is interested in. But I don't think universality is a problem, right? Because universality implies that the meanings don't change, and I don't think that's the case. I think the way the plays were read 400 years ago is probably very different from the way they're read now, and it's very different from the way they're read here. Right now is very different from the way, say, they would read to an African audience or an audience in Soviet Russia, in the Soviet Union, or in 18th century Britain. That changes. It just sort of happens to be the case that mm-hmm. Shakespeare's plays are very good at reading in different ways to different audiences over and over again.
Let's go back to the phones now. We've got Sean joining us in Kenosha. Hi, Sean.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment. I just recently read Hamlet, and I read Shakespeare in high school, and now I'm an older adult, and I loved it. And I was telling coworkers that I read Hamlet, and they were telling me that, oh, you're not supposed to read Shakespeare, you're supposed to see it on stage, and blah, blah, blah. But I told them my kids just recently have become infatuated with The Lion King, which is Hamlet.
Uh-huh.
You know, your uncle kills the father and marries the mother, and they love it. So that's my comment.
Right. Well, thank you for that. And actually, that's what occasioned our comment with Ira. We were talking about The Lion King initially and how it was essentially Hamlet, and that didn't hold water either for him. And just, Holger, before you jump in here, we did get a comment on Facebook that sort of dovetails nicely with Sean's. Joe said, reading Shakespeare kind of sucks, but seeing Shakespeare play is mind-blowing, especially with a good acting company like APT in Spring Green, Wisconsin. So a couple different takes on reading Shakespeare versus seeing it.
Yeah, I think, well, that's actually something that academic Shakespeareans also debate. It's one of the great questions of our field, whether Shakespeare is, whether we should read Shakespeare or study productions of Shakespeare. I'm sort of agnostic on that. I think Shakespeare is an author that functions very differently on stage than on the page, but I think Shakespeare is as much of a poet as he is a playwright. So I would advocate for the value of reading Shakespeare. I think there is a kind of richness of language that flies past you on stage. There's more in Shakespeare than any one production can realize. I mean, that's true for most plays, but it's particularly true for plays as poetically rich as Shakespeare's. But it's certainly also the case that most of Shakespeare's works remain theatrically powerful. Now, that has something to do with the fact that Shakespeare, as a playwright, has been enormously influential, and that has sort of stuck around in the theatrical canon of most Western theater cultures. So there's something, there's a kind of familiarity to the form there that is lost with a lot of other plays. I mean, it's much harder, I think, to make, a classical tragedy, so a tragedy from classical antiquity, Euripides, Sophocles, and so on, which are in many ways just as important and great works of dramatic literature as Shakespeare's plays. It's much harder to make those work for a modern audience because their form is slightly stranger. It's not the form we're used to. Characters don't work the same way, speeches don't work the same way, dialogue doesn't work the same way, characterization doesn't, and so on. So there's something about the way Shakespeare constructed his plays that had an enormous influence on the way Western drama has been written since then. And I think that helps to keep Shakespeare alive on stage in a way that a lot of other playwrights that didn't have the same influence and aren't part of the theatrical DNA of contemporary drama in the same way. So those playwrights who aren't like that have more of a problem surviving on the modern stage.
And we leave it there. Holger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Holger Syme, a professor of English and theater at the University of Toronto. We're talking about Ira Glass's recent tweet that Shakespeare sucks. And we want to know what you think about this. Is he being honest about something you've considered before? Or do you think he's completely all wet with that? You can let us know on the Central Time Facebook page.
The owners of all 30 Major League Baseball teams are gathering in Baltimore today to elect the league's first new commissioner since Bud Selig took over in 1992. It's a contentious process that may not yield a result today, hasn't as far as we know now. One thing is clear, whoever takes the job next year will have a lot on their plate. Their home plate. Sorry.
Well, the sport continues to do well in the United States. There are long-term economic concerns facing the sport, including a possible labor stoppage in 2016 and a growing National Football League, which may be siphoning off some baseball fans. And in today's busy world, there are some people who say that baseball just isn't relevant anymore.
Joining us now to talk about the business of baseball and the challenges facing a new Major League commissioner is Andrew Zimbalist. He's a professor of economics at Smith College and expert on sports business. His newest book is The Sabermetric Revolution, Assessing the Growth of Analytics in Baseball. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So from the economic standpoint, what is the state of Major League Baseball?
You guys did a nice job there summarizing it. On the one hand, the sport has been growing approximately 9 or 10% a year since the mid-90s when we had our last work stoppage in baseball, the strike in 94 and 95. Revenue has continued to grow overall in the sport. It's been driven in the last 5 years largely by local television deals, regional sports networks. But there have been a lot of new stadiums that have been brought online, and we've had labor peace in baseball since the strike of 94-95. Baseball used to be the sport that had labor unrest, but since 94-95, been 22 years of, not 22 years, but almost 20 years of labor peace, and the other sports have had disruptions. So all of that is, all of that's good news. The bad news is that the demographics of baseball's fandom is getting older and older. And the percent of youths in the United States who say baseball is their favorite sport has been falling. And obviously, going forward, you want to build as much of a fan base as you can amongst today's youngsters. It's the ability of youngsters to become adults and have kids and pass along the love of the sport that has kept baseball as the national pastime. And part of the problem, at least as perceived by many people within the industry, is that baseball takes too long. That the average game in the 1950s took about 2 hours, and today it takes about 3 hours. There's too much fidgeting and adjusting and hemming and hawing between each pitch. And, of course, the commercials have gotten a little bit longer as well. And people in today's world don't feel like sitting down and committing. It's an indefinite. It might be 3 hours on the average, but we don't know in baseball because it doesn't have a time clock, and you can have extra innings. And the game might be 3.5 or 4 or 4.5 hours. People are increasingly reluctant, it seems, to sit down and devote that much time of their evening or of their day to watching a baseball game. So there's a big debate within the ownership ranks about how they can move the game along more rapidly. It's not an easy thing to do, particularly since practically everything that you would do would have to be negotiated with the players' union.
Well, when it comes to these and some of the other challenges we're going to talk about, how important is the commissioner in all this?
Well, I think the commissioner is a central figure, and Bud Selig, of course, has been a central figure. Bud has not done very much to reduce the length of the games, and it's not going to be easy for anybody to reduce the length of the games, in part because of the fact that it all has to be negotiated with the players' union. But for anything positive to happen, anything constructive to happen, the commissioner has to play an agglutinizing role. The commissioner has to get all of the owners more or less on the same page. You've got 30 owners who are operating in different markets, usually vastly different economic markets, with spectacularly different conditions in terms of the number of large corporations, the size of the television market, the per capita income of the population, whether they own the stadium that they play in or not, and if they don't own it, what the lease terms are, the weather in the area. Every owner faces his or her own set of economic challenges, and because of that, each owner has their own idea about what needs to happen in baseball. And one of the things that was happening in baseball in 1992 when Bud took over as, at that point in time, a temporary commissioner, was that the owners were on each other's backs. They were screaming and hollering and kicking, and they couldn't even agree enough with each other to be able to sit down at the bargaining table with the players. What Bud Selig was able to do is to say to the owners, look, we're destroying the sport. We've got to behave more like gentlemen. We have to look at not just our own backyards, but we have to look at the backyards of all 30 teams. And if we don't do that, we're going to be in big trouble. Now, Bud was able to use that approach, and he was able to use some carrots and some sticks, and he got the owners to at least agree with each other enough that they had to stop bickering to begin to do some long-term planning. And it was his ability to do that and to maintain that modicum of peace amongst the owners that enabled baseball to innovate. Innovation means that you're making changes for the future. And so baseball was able to introduce a third division. They were able to first introduce one wild card and then two wild cards. They were able to introduce the International Baseball Classic or the World Baseball Classic. They're able to introduce BAM, MLBAM, or MLB.com, which is now the internet leader in the sports field. They've done a lot of things that they would never have been able to do in the 1980s, given the level of discord that existed. So in order to be able to begin to productively think about the problem of how can we adjust baseball today to meet the needs and desires of the youth of America today, in order to begin to address that, you have to first have some unity of purpose and to begin to fashion some unity of vision. And I think that is the first challenge of a commissioner. A commissioner You know, you might like to say, well, a commissioner should be handsome, a commissioner or beautiful, a commissioner should be articulate, a commissioner should have great charisma, a commissioner should be the most brilliant person ever to think about the television and media markets, and go on and on and on and on. You could say it would be wonderful if we had all of those characteristics. The fact of the matter is, to be a good leader, you need to get the people you're leading on the same page, number one. And then number two, you need to know where to go to find the experts. You need to engage in a constructive dialogue. The commissioner doesn't have to be an expert in television technology.
We're talking with sports economist Andrew Zimbalist about the business of baseball and what challenges await the league's new commissioner. And we want to hear from you, too.
In order to stay competitive, are there changes you think baseball needs to make? If you're not a fan of the game, is there anything that would win you over? Or would you like to see things stay just the way they are? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the future of baseball. Major League Baseball is in the process of selecting a new commissioner for the league, replacing longtime baseball boss Bud Selig. While the game is still raking in a lot of dollars, there are questions surrounding the sport's long-term prospects.
You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. New commissioner can mean new opportunities for baseball. Do you think baseball needs to change to stay competitive, maybe to fend off the NFL? Are there changes you think that baseball should make? If you're not a fan of the game, is there anything that could win you over? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Also wonder if maybe you used to like baseball, but some other sport has crowded it out in your affections. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Well, getting back to our discussion, looking at this transition with Bud Selig, one of the challenges we mentioned earlier is the NFL. I had thought that the NFL was actually stealing business from baseball. Baseball's still on the rise. But is there a concern that football is going to keep growing, Andrew Zimbalist, while baseball might reach its peak and then start declining?
I don't think that baseball owners have that concern, and I certainly don't have that concern. I would almost express the concern the other way around, which is that I think football has a very large challenge before it, which is how to deal with concussions without changing the basic violent nature of the game. And there are no easy answers to that. You can't simply change the equipment because the equipment's not going to protect the collision that the brain makes with the inside of the skull. So we have increasing information about this as a problem in football. We have suits that start at the NFL level but go down to the college and high school level. We have increasing concern amongst parents about this. So I'm not predicting the demise of football, but I think football actually has a much larger challenge before it. And in any event, I don't think baseball defines its success in terms of the number of people who go to football games, or certainly the number of eyeballs that watch football on television. Football long ago surpassed baseball as a more popular television sport.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Adams. Mike, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to say that I found myself, anyway, veering more towards Major League Baseball, watching the Brewers and listening to the Brewers, and being kind of pulled away from the NFL as of late, like in the last few years.
Why is that?
I think a lot of it is the old, you know, how people have been talking about the oversaturation of the NFL and a lot of the changes they're making. It just seems to be getting kind of over the top and almost kind of cartoonish. I mean, I'm still a big Packers fan, but I really enjoy baseball more, and I like the fact that there's not a clock. I like, you know, just the pure fun of the game more.
Interesting. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Andrew, that he's liking the relaxed pace that some people are worried about. So some people out there don't have that attention span issue when it comes to baseball.
Absolutely, and I'm one of them, because for me, life in the United States has become increasingly frenetic. And one of the things I love about baseball is that it's so languorous. And you either you go to the ballpark or you're watching on television, and it's 3 hours away from the freneticism of the rest of your life. So I find it relaxing, and certainly there are people out there like Mike and myself who believe that. I think, however, the concern is that if you look at the patterns amongst the youth, the people that the television audience that's below 18 years of age, you're finding a different experience and a different perception. So I think baseball would like to respond to that, and you know, there are some sensible ideas out there about limiting the amount of time that pitchers can take between pitchers, or restricting batters from stepping out of the batter's box in certain ways. Part of the problem, though, is that any such change is going to have to be negotiated with the union, and the union is representing players who have grown accustomed to a certain pace, and so it's simply not an easy thing to do.
One advantage people have pointed to for baseball is that it's substantially cheaper to go to a baseball game than any of the other big four sports in the country.
This is true. The average baseball ticket is somewhere in the neighborhood of $25 to $30, and the average ticket for basketball, football, and hockey is between $60 and $80. But the reason for that is that baseball plays twice as many games as hockey and basketball, and the baseball stadiums have capacities of 40 to 60,000, whereas basketball arenas have capacity of 15 to 20,000, more or less. And football, of course, they only play 8 regular season home games during the year, and hence the demand for tickets is that much greater than the available supply. If you're playing 8 games and there are 70,000 seats, there are only 560,000 tickets to sell, and so they can charge a lot more money for each ticket.
Back to our callers now with Bob in Waupaca. Hi, Bob.
Hi. My concern with baseball is its lack of competitiveness. I was an avid baseball fan in the 80s when the Brewers were competitive. But after the 1994 strike and the lack of a salary cap, institution of a salary cap, for the most part, the Brewers just became a minor league franchise where the good players ended up going other places. And I've basically turned off baseball since 1994. In football, any team can go from the cellar to the best. And any given year, it's happened multiple times, or from best to worst. And in baseball, it's basically just root against the Yankees or the other high-paid teams.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. He's voicing a concern. He's not alone there, Andrew.
Yeah, that's correct, and particularly if you're a fan of a team that's been doing poorly for a long period of time. The Brewers basically fall into that category. The Pittsburgh Pirates until last year fell into that category. Other teams fall into that category. Then sure, you get tired. But there have been longstanding terrible teams in all the other team sports as well. Baseball actually has more balance today than it's ever had. And you have more and more small market teams that are doing well. And it becomes harder and harder for teams like the Yankees or owners like Hal Steinbrenner to buy himself a World Series. The Yankees have had the highest payroll every year, including this year, although it's very close to the Dodgers, for about the last 15 years. They've only won the World Series once since 2001, and as your caller Bob probably knows, they're not doing terribly well this year. So you have to be a little bit patient. You have 30 teams in baseball. And not every team is going to do well every year, but I think Mr. Attanasio has got the Brewers moving in the right direction. That said, underlying the problem of imbalance is revenue imbalance and market size imbalance, and one of the ways that has been implemented over the last 15 years to deal with that is revenue sharing, is to take money out of Hal Steinbrenner's pocket, the Yankees' pockets, and put it into Mark Attanasio's pocket. And that does happen in a big way. The Yankees contribute over $100 million a year in revenue sharing. That sort of thing is very hard to do because you're basically appealing to the Hal Steinbrenners of the baseball world and saying, look, we know we're taking money out of your wallet, but we need to do this in order to make the sport stronger. And Hal Steinbrenner's position will be, my goodness, isn't there another way to make this sport much stronger. When I bought the Yankees, when my father bought the Yankees, nobody told us they were going to take half of our money away from us. It's actually not quite that bad for the Yankees. But anyway, competitive balance will always be an issue in baseball. It's an issue in the other sports as well. But it's simply not an easy, it's not an easy nut to crack.
We'll leave it there for now. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Andrew Zimbalist. He's a professor of economics at Smith College, an expert on sports business. His new book is The Sabermetric Revolution. And by the way, you can keep this conversation going. Tell us why you love or maybe fell out of love with Major League Baseball over at the Central Time Facebook page. In this week's Share Something segment, we check out some Wisconsin bands and get a look at the state's lively music scene. Andy Moore joins us now. He's a senior producer over at Wisconsin Public Television. He's the host of the 30-Minute Music Hour. It airs Saturday night at 10:30 on Wisconsin Public Television and Fridays at 6:30 over at the Wisconsin Channel. Andy Moore, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Veronica. It's nice to be here.
Well, first, is there such a thing as a Wisconsin music scene, or is it just a bunch of little scenelets spread out all over?
It seems like people like to assign, you know, a Wisconsin sound or a Seattle sound. Mostly, it seems to me that people assign sounds to cities, and I would be hesitant to assign a Wisconsin sound. And I think that's a good thing, but I see that there are scenelets, to use your word, and I see them forming a box for corners of a box that form a square.
So you're talking about cities or regions. What are the four corners of the box?
I think that the pulse point scenes in Wisconsin are happening in the Fox Valley, Appleton, Oshkosh, over in Eau Claire, as a lot of people will gravitate toward, especially in the national press.
Justin Vernon country.
Absolutely. and so many more. But it is like one big tribal family there. And then we have to throw Madison in, and then Milwaukee. So those are the corners of the pulse points.
And are bands kind of making their way? Do they tour around those four pulse points? Or are they really – is it rare that they breach their nucleus and get over to those other cities?
There's a tremendous amount of cross-pollination in Wisconsin, more and more all the time. And so there's lots of touring in and out of those markets, but there's a lot of musicians playing together. Christopher Porterfield out of Milwaukee is playing with people in the Fox Valley, and Justin Vernon is playing with people from Eau Claire and down in Milwaukee. It's kind of a commingling, kind of a family thing that happens in the state, it seems.
Are there cities on the music scene that might surprise us that aren't part of that the four city box you're talking about?
Well, sure. Baraboo, Wisconsin. Who would have thought that anybody would be talking about Baraboo, Wisconsin as a pulse point music scene? And, of course, many of your listeners will know and appreciate the tremendous amount of music, the volume, and the uniqueness of the music that the group Fox is making, PHOX. And they're from Baraboo. And just as Vernon seems to have hatched many artistic eggs in Eau Claire, not to get too barnyard about it. The scene in Baraboo has taken off quite a bit too. And Door County, you think about Door County, you think of fudge, but you know you get into Sturgeon Bay, the gateway to Door County, and the great Pat McDonald and his festival each June up there, Steel Bridge. It's an explosion. Now that's getting us up near the Fox Cities, but I would say those would be two maybe surprising places.
You mentioned there's not really exactly a Wisconsin sound. We cover a lot of different genres in these in all the cities you've mentioned.
We do. I like and I think that they have their own sound. Fox Valley tends to rock harder. Maybe it's that more of a lunch bucket, blue collar kind of thing. Now, Corey Chisel, who is a tremendous artist and maybe the Fox Valley's most famous son, tends to rock a little lighter and be more folk rock. But the Fox Valley bands that are up and coming are fairly unapologetic rock. Now, that's opposed over in Eau Claire, and I call the Eau Claire sound flannel mysticism.
I love that.
The kind of thing where you can hunker down and sort of, you know, stare at your boots and your Carhartts and worry about all the things that Bon Iver worries about. But there's also lots of packaging in that sound. It's very highly produced, as you know, if you listen to some of those groups. Daredevil, Christopher Wright, extremely high concept music from Eau Claire. We Are the Willows, almost warble. But it works somehow. S. Carey, who was in Bon Iver, these are all terrific characters and colorful, but very filled with flannel and mysticism. Justin's new project, he's taking on an alter ego. Maybe you've heard of it, and I might even be mispronouncing it. This is very new, Ephesus, for a new supergroup that he's calling Jason Feathers, but very, very ponderous. We can come down to Madison and Milwaukee and talk about those places too, but each corner seems to be doing their own thing.
Well, before we get to the music, how does 30-minute music hour fit in? Have you become a player on the scene?
Well, I guess that's for others to decide. I tell you, though, the program has, I think, pointed music lovers in directions I like to think that they might not have found on their own. I also like to bring Wisconsin bands on that are extreme in their genre. That is to say that a band that I think we'll sample in a moment, the Traveling Suitcase, may appeal to a great number of people, but may not appeal to a great number of people. And I feel like it's my purpose to not worry about who likes it and who doesn't, but to pick out the quality such as we can identify that, and then hope that the audience will say, well, maybe I'll like next week. I don't know, something like that.
Well, Andy, so let's get to some of the tracks that you have shared with us today. These are all performers who have been on the Music Hour over time. Let's start over in the Milwaukee corner of Wisconsin's Music Box with Classic in Milwaukee. Tell us a little bit about Classic.
A tremendous melding of R&B, old school R&B, but with some really edgy soul. I call it soul hop. This is a young act, a hungry act, a very professional, very going places act.
Classic was at the big South by Southwest Music Festival this year, right?
And they made a huge splash down there. It's like I said, I think it's the melding and the sort of the cross identification across music forms that they do so well. They're also just really good looking and really, really fun to watch.
Nice.
And so they're just a colorful to the eyes and to the ears.
All right, well, let's move from Milwaukee over to Eau Claire. This is rocking a little more than some of what you talked about in Eau Claire. Meridine, am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's right. A terrific Eau Claire band, part of what I call the Amble Down sound. That's the record label that Kyle Furnett started up there. When we have ringing guitars and crystal clear vocals, we've got what amounts to a great pop band from Eau Claire called Meridine.
Meridine is part of that scene in Eau Claire, which is one of the four corners you mentioned, Andy. What do you like best about this band?
I like how they communicate together, and I guess that's a sight thing. I always really like bands that are not playing rote. And I just love Carl's vocals. The vocals that Joe brought up for us, it's just crystal clear, it's diamond hard. I just love to hear him sing, and they're upbeat and poppy in a kind of a throwback way.
And then we move over to Oshkosh. You shared the Traveling Suitcase with us. You say they're a rocking band. I pulled a clip that's a little more mellow, but talk about it.
Yes. You can still hear Nicole Ray's strong, strong vocals. When she sings, even a more mellow song like this, people want to compare her to Janis Joplin. Hmm. You can really hear it when she rocks hard. She's also the band's drummer, which is really a fun and unique thing. Whenever you see a band, whether it's a trio or a quartet led by a drummer, it's just awesome to see a singer drummer.
Sorry I strung, sorry I strung, sorry I strung. You'll
All right, one, clip two, there from the Traveling four. Suitcase band from Oshkosh. Andy, as you've done this, the 30-minute music hours in its seventh season, as you go along, are you seeing some of the bands that you've had on explode, get big?
Well, that's been fun. And we mentioned Fox earlier, and we had them on a couple of seasons ago. And since that time, they've really, really have exploded. When you consider they grew up in the shadow of the Culvers and Baraboo, you know. that's been a great deal of fun. But we've also had the pleasure of putting on musicians who never will, but mm-hmm. should be. Hmm. And that I think the audiences have come to appreciate too.
You get to see these shows really at ground zero. I mean, you're right up there seeing them live. Do you want to make the case for more people getting out and checking out bands and seeing them in person around the state?
Yeah. There's a big controversy in Madison over the Make Music Madison Day, and a lot of professional performers I know say that all that does is keep people from paying for music because it's a free citywide concert kind of thing. I feel like if people are exposed to watching performers make music live, no matter what the cost, especially free, it may get some people out to the club. How could it not?
Yeah. And then you get them hooked on music.
Right. Exactly.
Well, who else is coming up on the 30-Minute Music Hour this month?
Well, on the 23rd of August, a terrific second-line parade band, a New Orleans-style brass band, Mama Dig Down's Junction.
Yeah, they've been around a while. They're
they sure have. And these guys now are from all over the state and all over the Midwest. And so that's a great episode. Chance is an act that will be on at the end of the month. This is a soloist, speaking of drummers, who creates what I call his own soundscape by samples right before your eyes and then puts a live drum track to it. And if that sounds kind of stuffy or lab-like, it's anything but. It's filled with emotion and movement, and it's really fun to watch. And then one of the most bizarrely gifted songwriters, I think, that is in the state right now, goes by an alias, William Z. Villain, and he'll be on September 6th.
All right. Sounds like a lot of fun. Andy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Really enjoyed it.
That was Andy Moore, host of the 30-Minute Music Hour. It airs Saturday night at 10:30 on Wisconsin Public Television and Fridays at 6:30 on the Wisconsin Channel.